And Chris, when I put money into my private bank and I take it out and give it to you, the money that I give you, it doesn't leave my account. And I'm like, whoa, wait, my mic. Like, I'm literally paying him to give me my own money back and charge me interest a second time while he still made interest the whole time on the money. When I heard this, I'm just like, this can't be real.
Hello and welcome. My name is Gino Barbaro, one of the co-founders of Jake and Gino. And today's guest, he went from pro snowboarding to money mogul. Chris Naugle is currently the founder of The Money School, which teaches you to be your own bank. As an innovator in wealth building and real estate, he empowers entrepreneurs with the knowledge of how money works so they can solve their money problems and take back control. Without further ado, welcome to the show, Chris.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me on. What an honor.
This is going to be a lot of fun today because I know you like to talk about money. I think money is so central to what we need to do in life. It's not everything, but without it, you basically don't have all the optionality that you want to have. Why don't you share with the listeners your story? Because I saw some pro snowboarding in there, and now you're a money guy. How did you make that leap?
Oh, yeah. It's a cool story. So I didn't grow up with money, and I grew up actually in a really lower income family. My mom raised me, so my dad really wasn't too much in the picture. But growing up, like I lived out in the town, and all I ever fixated on was skateboarding because I didn't have anywhere else to go. So we built ramps and then BMX. And then my best friend Jack at the time, one October, brought over a snowboard. And I'm like, this is cool. All winter we can do this. And that was it. And I didn't have money, and my mom didn't have money to let me go to the hill. So right up from my house in the dirt, like we used to ride dirt bikes, and we had a track that we built, but there was a couple hills up there. So I used to take my plastic snowboard back then. Like I didn't have a real snowboard. It was a Mogul Monster. And I would literally build jumps out of sticks and snow, swear. And we'd hike up and we'd just hit that jump and hit it and hit it and hit it. And then one day, you know, he brought me to the resort, and that's when things got real. So here, how the whole story went is, you know, I've always been a kid that hyper focuses on things. So when I got an idea in my head, there was nothing that would change that idea. And I remember I watched a snowboard film, and this would have been late 80s. I can't remember what it was called, but I just became infatuated with becoming a pro snowboarder. But everybody I told this in school and my parents, they all said, you'd have to move. You can't do that around here. We don't have mountains. We have hills. But then I'm at the hill, Kissing Bridge was the name, and I had heard that there was going to be two pro Burton riders. Their names were Blair and Shane, and they were going to be at the resort. So I skipped school. My mom wasn't happy, but I went out there, and I literally poached up in the park until these two pro riders showed up. And I remember all day, I'm just watching them with their filmer because they were filming for a video, and I would just trail them down the hill, and I would just do laps with them. And then Blair like saw me, you know, because I was clearly stalking them. And he called me over and he said, hey, take laps with us. You know, what's your name? And we got into it. That whole moment that happened there, all it did is crystallized in my mind that it was possible. So that's how I became a pro snowboarder. And it wasn't because I was traveling around with parents taking me to contests. It was because of sheer will. Like we had a country club by my house and it was in a ravine. And I couldn't go to the hill because mom, we just didn't have the money to pay for lift tickets and, you know, 45-minute trek there. So my mom would drop me off after school. Like she'd pick me up from school, drop me off at this country club, go home. And I had about anywhere between an hour to an hour and a half before it was pitch dark. Because you know how winters are. It's dark right after school. So I got in the habit of like running up the hill. I'd build a jump. So that would take a little time, and I'd run up the hill and I would just drill all the tricks I'd see in the magazines. I did this every day. And on weekends, I spent the entire day there. And then, so clearly then when I had the chance to go to the resorts on the weekends, I had this stuff dialed. So then I started competing, and lo and behold, I mean, I started winning and winning more, and I got noticed, and I became a pro snowboarder at the age of 19. That was my utmost dream. But in there, something else happened, and you know, a lot of things overlap, so I want your audience to know that. I had started a clothing line in my mom's basement called Fat Clothing Company, PHAT. It was my first business. I was 16 years old. I'd literally just turned 16 because I got a job at a pizza shop, a pizza Italian place, and the guy treated me so badly that the day I quit, I said, I'm never working for anyone again. Hence the business. I couldn't quit on mom. So that's what fueled the snowboarding. I would literally make shirts with my art teacher, Mr. Michalski, after school. I would sell them out of my backpack to all the kids in the high school because I went to a pretty big school. And then I recruit my friends by giving them a couple shirts to sell out of their backpacks. It was my sales team. I didn't know it, but that's just what we did. That's what paid for my car. You know, I just drove a $500 car, and that's how I got there. So everything was awesome. 17 years old comes. I had three seamstresses working for me, making snowboard gear, and I had gone out to sell my clothing. Every time I would travel, I'd sell my clothing on the road. And this one guy who owned a shop, his name was Tim, you know, said, "Hey, do you want to go snowboarding?" And I'm like, "Oh, yeah, when?" He says, "Now. I'll shut the shop down." And I'm like, "Wait a second, you can just close the doors?" He's like, "Yeah, I own the place." Clearly, another idea, I got to have my own shop. So November of 1994, my first retail store opened. It was called Fat Man, P-H-A-T, Board Shops. They're still open today. I sold them, but they're still in existence, you know, from 94 all the way to 2024 almost. And my mom did something crazy because I needed 70 grand to open this store and I didn't have it. So I almost got shut down. I almost gave up, but my mom saw this happening and we lived in a 2-bedroom, 1-bath house, 700 square feet. And my mom put that house on the line so that as collateral, so I could get that SBA backed loan. So that's how I became an entrepreneur. So now how do we go from snowboarding into like the advisory or the Wall Street world? Well, dot-com crash, right? Early 2000s. Never forget, I had three stores going, pro snowboarder, living the life. And then when the planes hit the tower and we went into the recession, that was the first experience I had with a recession. And that recession brought my business down 30%. I feel like it was overnight. So I needed a job and I put resumes out. I had no resume. I mean, I had a year and a half of college. I had these retail stores. I was a pro snowboarder and that's it. One page resume. And the only places that called me back was Wall Street. So, of course, I didn't know what else to do. So I took the job in Wall Street, and I stayed in Wall Street for 16 years. A lot happened through there. I still had my stores. I still snowboarded. I had, you know, this whole Wall Street business that I became really freaking good at. I was like one of the top three advisors, and it was all because it was so simple. Like, you know, it's. Sometimes in life, like especially right now, I want to parallel back then because that was back in the early 2000s that I went into Wall Street. And let me just tell you what I saw. I went in there and I saw a bunch of advisors in these glass offices around the thing. I was a pond scum in the middle. We just dialed for dollars and passed them off to these guys. But all these guys made a ton of money. And I watched them vividly because I wanted one of those offices. They would show up at 8:39 in the morning. They would leave for 2-hour lunches and they were gone. I mean, gone as fast as they could by 4:30 in the afternoon. And I just said, "What the hell is this?" I'm like, if I get here at 7, I can get all this paperwork done before we hit the phones. And then I can work through lunch because these guys are going to go out to lunch. I don't have money to go out to lunch. I'll pound the phones through lunch and people answered. And then I'll schedule calls after these guys leave and I'll go see people at their kitchen tables. And I did that for years. And that's how I went from pond scum, if you will, to one of the top three advisors in that firm in a relatively short period of time, about 6 years. Seems like a long time, but in that, it's a very short period of time. And I was the guy that everybody else was looking up to with that corner office. That's how I did it, man. And so much happened in between there, but I'm just going to hit the brakes and pause because that brought me, you know, right up to the time when real estate entered and real estate would have entered in 2008. But let's just digress on some of that.
So what did you learn about money at the Wall Street job?
Everything that I would tell everybody not to do today. I learned traditional financial knowledge that most people know. You know, you make money and you give it to somebody else to control. And that somebody else was me. I mean, that's what I did. I was a trained salesperson. That's all an advisor is a trained salesperson. And I think today advisors absolutely have forgotten what their job actually is. They think that their job is to just grow people's wealth. Their job is to protect people's money when things go down. Because when things are going up, like the last 12 years, the longest bull run in history, it's not hard to make money in Wall Street, in the markets. Like, but when things fall apart, like they soon will, and like they're already starting to, that's when an advisor really needs to do their job. Now, I will tell you, yes, was I trained on that? But did we actually actively do what we were trained on? No. We just sold products and tried to get anybody that would give us money to manage. And we charged a fee, you know, about 1.25% is what our management fee was. And we just, that's what we did every day. And it was a dog eat dog world. Everything that I learned was sales and listening to the guys, the consultants tell me like, oh, this fund is so good. This product is the best thing. This is the problem it solves. And then we'd just go out and sell it. And there was always incentives and bonuses for selling more of this or that. There's leaderboards. So a lot of people don't understand the inside of what it's like. And I will tell you now, being out of it, I retired in 2018 and sold my practice when we got our show on HGTV. But it's a sad state of affairs. Advisors get paid whether you make money or lose money. They very rarely are really looking out for you because they got hundreds of clients. I mean, you can't literally manage hundreds of accounts in an active way. So you just shove them in a separately managed account and hope for the best. And when things fall apart and your client calls, that's when you actually have to do work. It's never proactive. It's always reactive. And I'm not speaking for all advisors, but this is just what I saw. Traditional financial advice that you give will teach you one thing or do one thing for you. It will teach you how to give up control of your money, which is the exact opposite of what you need to be doing. You need to be controlling your money, but we're taught to give it up.
So what are some of the biggest mistakes you see that people make with money?
It's hard to say where I don't even know where to start and stop. The biggest mistakes people make, and I'll tell you this, the fastest way to wealth is through your own debts and expenses. So let me just preface that. That is the fastest way to wealth. But here's what most people do. They make money, okay? They take the money, they put it into the bank, or they take a small chunk of what they make, they put it in their 401k, and maybe they invest a little bit with their advisor in a brokerage account, all of which that money is no longer in your control. Even the bank. People are like, oh, the money in the bank is in my control. Wrong. You gave control up to the bank. You're not the one making the spread. The bank isn't calling you saying, hey, Chris, Gino needs a loan and we think he's a good fit. We can send you over his whole loan packet and you can review it. We'd like to loan him $10,000 worth of your money that we have here on savings. Can you get back to us in the next 24 hours? Gino would really appreciate that. Does the bank say that? No. So you mean to tell me that the bank doesn't have control of your money? Because they do. You gave it to them. You signed a paper you didn't read that said you gave up control, and the bank takes your money and gives it to anyone they want at a higher rate than what they pay you. And it's a much higher rate. If they pay you 3, they're charging 8, okay, by to call it today's numbers. And in the middle is the magic. That's the spread, you know, and that's what we all need to do. And by taking back control of your money, you can then make the spread. But the biggest mistake people make is they do all that, but then on the other side of the equation, on their budget, you've got assets and you got liabilities, they rack up credit cards. We're setting records right now for credit card debt at the highest interest rates we've been at since the 80s. But yet we rack up our credit cards, we take out car loans, we take out mortgages. And then over on the other side, what are we doing? We're giving money, we're investing money in risky assets. Folks, listen, stop investing. Take the money that you have, that you save, and start paying off your credit cards. Like, start with the lowest balance first. Pay that credit card off. Just pay it off before that money goes anywhere. Then take the amount you paid the credit card. Let's call it $100, 29% interest. And then have that $100 go into another bank account that you set up. Set up a second bank account at a bank that you don't go to a lot. And just have that money every month auto sweep into that bank account. Do you know what you just made? You just made 29% on your money by recycling and recapturing money you're giving away. So that's the first mistake people make. The second mistake people make is they listen to everybody else and they think everybody else has their best intentions in mind. You know, I still hear it today. Oh, you got a dollar cost average into the markets. Well, maybe that's not a bad strategy, but you got to put money in the S&P 500. You got to buy this indexed IUL, policy. You got to do all these things. I'm just like, whoa, you are telling people to put money in the markets at the absolute wrong time. You're buying high. Warren Buffett spelled it out. So that's the second big mistake. People do things in the exact opposite order of when they should because of FOMO and because everybody else is doing it. They follow the herd off the cliff. Like right now, don't put any money in the markets. Matter of fact, hold money back. Get liquid. Keep your money safe because the biggest opportunity of your life is right around the corner and all you need to do is be ready to pounce. But yet so many people just keep going in. And then when it goes off the cliff, they sell low. Because they get scared at about 20, and I went through 2008 as an advisor, around 20, 25%. There's something that flips in people's minds and emotions. And they instantly are like, I can't lose anymore. I can't. And they're out. You can't get that back. It's called the drawdown effect. You'll never recover from that. But if you had just waited, been patient, and just, you don't even need to be good at investing. Literally just wait and watch the news and watch the carnage, the blood in the streets. And then when you start seeing that, then just say, yeah, man, I'm going to put a little bit in now. And then as it keeps getting worse, you put a little bit more in. That's how you get crazy wealthy. And I don't care if it's into the stock market or into real estate or anything. That's how you get wealthy, is you stop focusing on FOMO and you start focusing on pure logic, because logically, like, you know what's the right thing to do. It's just your emotions take over and put you in the wrong positions in most cases.
Let me know what you think about some of those money myths. I mean, you've talked about big mistakes, but there's a lot of myths out there with money. Let's dispel some of those. And after that, I want you to speak to the listener and say, this is where you can start. If I'm a new person, if I'm hearing this for the first time and I've drunk the Kool-Aid and I'm using the 401ks and I've got high credit card debt, let's tackle that next. But any kind of money myths out there that you've really, I mean, you've been in the financial sector, so you must have heard a ton of them where it's spoken as gospel, but really when you peel back the onion, they just don't make any sense.
Well, I mean, I think right now one of the biggest money myths is that a 401k is a good place for you to store your wealth. And also another money myth is that you think that retirement is the almighty and like that's the greatest day ever. If you retire and you do what a lot of retirees do, you just stop working, you stop doing things and you don't have a passion. Maybe you go golf for a year, maybe 2 years, that'll fizzle out. Guess what happens next? You die. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Another money myth is when you put all your eggs in a basket, like a 401k, however many years you have that money's going in the 401k, that's dead money. Oh no, it's not, Chris. It's growing. It's dead money. Because how many opportunities in the 5, 10, 15, or 20 years that you put money into the 401k did you have to give up? And sometimes people forget this. Like people are short-term memory. They always say, oh, I didn't give up any opportunities. What about when that guy came to you with that great real estate opportunity and said, hey, do you want to partner in this deal? Or hey, would you like to get in on this deal? And you're like, oh, I can't. I don't have any money. Sure you do. Your money's locked up in your 401k. But yet you say, oh, I don't have any money. Why? Because you don't have any liquid. Like, so a money myth is that saving for retirement using qualified retirement plans, not self-directed IRAs, but traditional retirement 401ks, 457s, is the best way that you're going to get ahead. Absolute money myth, 100%. And the other thing too that I think a lot of people screw up on, and this is another money myth, is in terms of where they store their money. A lot of people, when they think liquidity, they think of money markets, today not a bad place to go, or bank accounts. That's where they store massive amounts of money at traditional banks. And that is not the best place for you to store your immediate liquid money. So, and this is going to take a lot of people by surprise, but I don't care whether you believe me, do some research. Study the wealthiest families throughout history, the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, the Morgan family, the Stanley family. I mean, Ray Kroc, Walt Disney, you could go right up into the sitting president today, you know, not even to go there to the dude is what I like to call him. But all of these wealthy families have all done one thing that's been exactly the same throughout time. And that is they've taken back control of their money and they've created their own private banking systems, or some of them called it the family banking system in terms of the Rockefellers. But nobody ever takes another step. We all have heard that, right? Oh, the Rockefeller family banking system or private banking system. Oh, this private banking system. Oh, that private banking system. But you know what that is? A lot of people think, oh, it's a private banking system. Right, yeah. But where is that money? If it's a private banking system, that would first logically tell you that it's not at somebody else's bank. It's their own private banking system. And then a lot of people are like, oh, well, all those names you just said, they're bankers, so they just own their own bank. Wrong again. Maybe they do own their own bank, but their wealth, you know where it is? It's not at banks at all, because banks, and if you haven't been following the news, banks are not secure today. Like, look, Citizens, just the fifth bank this year, like down, done, over. Silicon Valley, Republic, Signature, I could keep going, RBS. They're not even putting their money in banks. They're putting their money in the safest financial institution that has been around for hundreds of years, and it is none other than giant mutually owned insurance companies. Private banking, and I could go on, deferred compensation plans, all of them don't use traditional financial products. They use an age-old product that is incredibly boring, is hated by a lot of people because they don't understand it, and it is at a giant mutually owned insurance company. And that product is a whole life insurance policy from a mutually owned company that pays dividends. But right there, when you say that, their mind says, oh my God, Dave Ramsey said that's the worst place you can put your money. That's an overpriced, high commission product. Dave Ramsey's not wrong. If you just look at the surface and you just say a whole life's a whole life's a whole life, that would be like me telling you, Gino, that a Ford Focus only comes in one model, right? There's only one model of Ford Focus and it's the sexiest car alive. Everybody would be like, this guy's crazy. But then if you watch YouTube, the late Ken Block, if you remember, at one point in his career, he drove a Ford Focus. And you could find lots of videos of him going 130 miles an hour sideways in full control in a beast that was a Ford Focus. So what's the difference between the one on the showroom floor and in Ken Block's Ford Focus? Design and engineering. That's it. It's the only difference. So a whole life insurance policy can be designed and engineered to do a lot of things. And that's exactly what these wealthy families did. They took the most stable institutions there are, insurance companies, a product available that has guarantees all the way through, called a whole life policy, and they designed and engineered it to work for a private banking system, which means instant liquidity when you put your money in it, which means guaranteed growth, which means uninterrupted compounding interest on your money even when you want to use it. Because if you're in banking, you want a place where you can take your dollars, and this is real estate too. Real estate's constantly got money going in and out, and you always need complete liquidity of your money. So we always use bank accounts. But same thing happens with a whole life policy if it's designed right. You can take your money, put it in it, immediately in the first 30 days when your check clears, take that money out, a large percentage of it, up to 90%, and redeploy that money in a real estate deal. But the thing that most people don't know, let's just start with 100 grand for simple numbers. I put 100 grand in the policy, and I get a real estate deal that I need 90 grand for. So I put 90 grand in. How much money's left in my account at that insurance company? Started with 100, took 90 out. How much is left?
You got 10 grand left in cash value.
It's what everybody thinks, right? Wrong. You got 100 grand left.
You got 100 grand left. Yep.
Yeah, because you never used your money. It's the only institution that you can do this with. You see, the insurance companies will allow you to use their money in their general account, which they got lots of it, because they have to have that money in the general account to make sure that the second guarantee the insurance company gave you, which is the death benefit, can be paid out if you ever died unexpectedly. But the insurance company just says, hey, we promised you on this policy, we'll pay you a $500,000 death benefit. So if you need 90 grand of the 500 while you're living, sure, we'll give it to you. We'll loan it to you. So they give you 90 grand of your death benefit. They use your 100 grand or 90 of it as collateral. But what that allows your money to do is continue growing at a guaranteed interest rate plus dividends. So remember how I said a bank makes money? They make it in a spread. I'll bring it all full circle. Bank pays you 3. They charge you 8 when you want to use your money, right? That's the spread in the middle. Well, an insurance company, you can do the same thing. The insurance company, will just use roundabout numbers for one of the companies, pays you 6% gross and allows you to use your death benefit, okay? So, but they when they let you use the death benefit, that is a loan from the insurance company and they do charge interest. So they charge 5. By today's numbers, it's a little less than 5. We'll just round up. So what's the spread there? It's 1%, right? Mm-hmm. But next year, let's say that real estate deal earns net rental. So you take the net rental and you then take that money and you put it back in the policy because that's your banking system. You just paid the loan down, okay? So the loan is now less. The insurance company is still charging you 5, but your effective APR is lower than 5 because you paid the balance down, but your money still over in your account is earning 6% compounding. So one is going up, the other is going down. Every year, if you do this, your spread gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and it doesn't require you to work harder, longer, or take on more risk. It's simple mathematics. This is why the wealthiest families do this. It's pure liquidity, pure compounding growth. And in a tax-free environment, all the interest you earn in the policy is tax-free. And you get access to use your money and make money on the same dollar twice. Plus, if you die, your family gets a death benefit tax-free. So like, that's the biggest thing. So I didn't mean to go long on that, but like, that's the myth. That's when I learned this, that's when it all changed for me.
So for me, I've got whole life policies on all 6 of my kids.
Yep.
And what people have to understand, it is a non-correlated asset. It's not an investment. You're not chasing yield with this. So if you decide to retire next year and the market tanks 40%, it's non-correlated. So it sits there and you can pull the money out. It's tax advantaged. You want to pay money on the seed, not on the harvest. That's the problem. With the 401k, you're paying on the harvest. So at the end, you think you have $1 million, but you really have between $500,000 and $600,000 once you take away taxes and you're gifting it. So it is a long-term strategy. I'm not going to tell you you're going to make money in the next 2 or 3 years, but whenever you're building a business, think of seeding a whole life policy as in building a business. It's going to take a couple of years for it to start working itself, but that's okay. You have the liquidity there. It's a cash management tool. And the way Chris described it, I'm going to get into the real estate question. We used to call it the dual asset strategy. You have one asset here, which is the whole life policy. You borrow money from that asset to buy a real estate business, real estate building, real estate asset. From the cash flow from the real estate, you pay back the loan. And hence, now you have two assets instead of one asset. And oh, by the way, if you're a Canadian trucker and your banks get frozen, well, guess what? Whole Life does not get frozen. It's never, out of the system. So, I mean, I don't preach to the choir, but I'm just trying to make the listeners understand that you really need to take a deeper dive. And I've interviewed dozens of eight-figure net worth individuals. Every single one of them has Whole Life as part of their plan. I think anyone with seven-figure net worth, I'd say between 75% and above, they do. When your net worth starts dropping down, you start getting into those money myths. You start getting into the financial planners with the 401ks and the 529s. The goal is to save money to buy an asset and have that asset pay for the event. That is what was my idea. I was taught as the middle class person to save for the event, like a 401k, like a 529. The problem is when that event is over, the savings are gone. But when you're putting that money into an asset and allow that asset to pay for the event, game over, game changer. And that's why real estate is so powerful. How do you have real estate as part of your component of creating wealth?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Well, I mean, you kind of know my story, but let me tell your audience a little bit. So I didn't go past 2008. So in 2006, I did my very first flip. 2007, I did another. In 2008, right before the Great Recession, I bought a dilapidated building that I was going to turn into a strip mall where my main Fat Man store was going to be. I almost went bankrupt during that. But after that, I started buying. I made it through. My wife, Larissa, and, you know, back then my girlfriend, paid my utilities and my mortgage to get us through that period of time. But in 2009 to 14, I started buying apartment buildings. Now, I didn't learn about this strategy, the infinite banking concept, until about 2014. So I was doing it the old-fashioned way. And because I was doing it the old-fashioned way, I wasn't being efficient and I wasn't getting very far very fast. In 14, I met a really wealthy, wealthy real estate developer and investor out in Utah. And he liked me, so he lent me money. And then one day at a Cheesecake Factory out in Salt Lake City, I just asked him, I said, "So Mike, how do you lend all this money?" And he says, "I lend from my private bank." Now, if I told somebody that, the first thing they're going to think is that person owns a bank. Exactly what I thought. I'm like, "Mike, you got a bank. Holy cow, why don't we go to your bank? Like, let's check it out." But he didn't. And he starts describing his banking system and all the things I said. You know, "I put my money in this institution." He didn't tell me what it was. I don't know why. And you probably see this too, Gino, is, you know, all those eight-figure people and part of the seven-figure folks that are using this, they rarely ever talk about it. It's kind of almost like it's always been this hidden secret, like, club almost.
It's not sexy. That's why.
It's not sexy at all. At all. And like you had mentioned, it takes a couple of years. Absolutely. You will. If you apply this private banking system to your life, you will not make money for 3 years. I'll be honest with you. You're just not. If we do a dump in, we can get you there in 2 years. But there will be 3 years that you'll have less money that you've put, or less money to take out than you put in. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. You'll have a death benefit, but you'll have less money. But every year, now remember this, every year after that third or maybe fourth year at the worst, every year for the rest of your life, every dollar you put in, you will take out more than what you put in. And every year that goes by, you'll take out more than you did the prior year. Just let that sink in, folks. And you didn't have to do anything different to change it. It's simply mathematics. So would you give up 3 years of gains or growth to make money guaranteed for the rest of your life and every year you get a raise? I think everybody would agree. Well, of course I would. Then why aren't you doing this? So this Mike guy starts telling me about all this stuff that he's doing, the uninterrupted compound interest. Where he got me, because I was an advisor and I'm trying to articulate in my mind, what is he talking about? It's guaranteed. It's got dividends. It's tax-free. I'm thinking Roths. I'm thinking self-directed. I'm thinking all these things. And then he drops the bomb and he says, "And Chris, when I put money into my private bank and I take it out and give it to you, like I'm going to do with this deal, the money that I give you never comes from, it doesn't leave my account." And I'm like, whoa, wait, Mike. You got 200 grand in your account. I need 200 grand. You take 200 grand out and you still have 200 grand in there. That makes no sense. And then he goes back and he tells her, you know, he says everything that I just said. He says, "It's a Whole Life policy designed and engineered to do something different. So when I take the money and give it to you, it's not my money. It's the insurance companies. They give me my death benefit early and you use that death benefit money. So my money just collateralizes the loan. The insurance company is not going to give me an uncollateralized loan, but they got my cash value that they're still paying me interest on." So he said, "Chris, like, I know you're paying me 15% interest on that. What I do with the interest you pay me is I just take the interest every month that you give me and I put it back in the policy, which means every penny of what I put back in the policy, I have to use the next day. So when you come back to me for another loan, you're literally funding your own freaking loan." I'm not going to, you know, he didn't tell me that, but I figured that out. Like, I'm literally paying him to give me my own money back and charge me interest a second time. while he still made interest the whole time on the money. When I heard this, I'm just like, this can't be real. But here's the thing, and Gino, you know this. I was an advisor 16 years. I'm one of the few that comes from that Wall Street world. So like, I look at this from a different lens because I'm just like, why wasn't I taught this? 16 years, not one time ever was I taught that Whole Life could do this. And I knew what Whole Life was. We sold it. And never was I shown this. And I went to my old managing partner after I retired and I sat him down. His name was John Foster. And I said, John, I got to just ask you, why wouldn't you have taught, you asked him, do you know what the infinite banking concept is? He says, yes. I said, do you know what BOLI is? Bank owned life insurance. He said, yes. I said, why didn't you ever teach us this? And he says, well, and his answer is very simple. He says, so you remember in the beginning when you started, there was like 25 New Org agents in that room with you. And then do you remember year two, how many were in there? I'm like, I don't know, maybe 10. And he said, year three. And I'm like thinking, and I'm like, shoot, was it just me? Maybe Vinay was still there. So maybe there was two of us left out of 20 some. And he says, okay, so just remember that. He said, it's very hard for us to keep agents and advisors because we're commission only. So now we're going to teach them, we're going to teach you this great thing called infinite banking that's modeled after BOLI. We're going to then show you how to strip your commissions down by 60 to 90%. So your client has 60 to 90% more money.
Yes.
How many agents do you think are in that room after 3 years? His answer was very simple. He said zero. They'd never make it because they'd have to give up 60 to 90% of their income. And even without giving their income up, we still only had two after 3 years. So that's why this can't be taught. There's no agency or brokerage out there that will ever teach this because it takes the one thing that keeps agents here, a commission check, and chops it down by 30 or 60 to 90%. So you can't make this a scalable model. It'll never work.
Yeah, I love that. Before we take a quick time out for the sponsors, wow, you've laid it out so eloquently. I mean, you're going to get Chris's information. Chris, where can they reach out for information? Before we go to the show, give me your websites. Give me all your information. I want people to reach out to you.
They can go to beyourownbanker.com and there's case studies, or just go to chrisnoggle.com and a 90-minute video will come up that will teach you exactly everything we just talked about. So beyourownbanker.com or chrisnoggle.com.
And I love the strategy because for me, it is long-term. It's liquid. It's safe. There are guarantees. The way you said, you put a dollar in and you take more than a dollar out. It really is a cash management tool. That's what I love about it more than anything else. And it fits really well with real estate investors. Now, I wanted to ask you this on the other side of the show, but I think this is really important. What's the difference between making money and keeping it? It seems as if Whole Life is a great way of actually keeping your money. Let's talk about making it versus keeping it.
So everybody's good at making money, right? Like every real estate investor I've ever met is good at making money. What real estate investors and anybody I think that's good at making money is terrible at is keeping it because they've never been taught the difference between rich and wealthy. The difference between rich and wealthy is wealthy individuals have learned how not to give the money back through proper risk mitigation. Now there's nothing complicated. You know, your advisor makes risk mitigation complicated. It's so simple. When you make money, put it somewhere where you can't lose it. And then use just new monies to invest further. Like I've written a couple books on this, but like that's the difference. So making money is easy. Keeping it's the hard part. Life and everything around you is all about giving up that money. And I know we're going to a commercial in a second, but let me just pose you this one thing. I love cars. We were talking offline. Like I have a G-Wagon, a GLS 63 and two Porsches, like, right? Nice cars. But you know why I have nice cars? It's because I get all the money back for every single car I ever buy, drive, and own. So it doesn't matter what I pay for those cars. All of it comes back to me. You want to know why the wealthy get wealthier? That's why. Because they understand how to never give their money back. And I'll finish that car thing in a second because it's right along the same topic. But like, just let that simmer as we go to commercial.
Let's take a quick time out to hear from our sponsors.
Now, we have had a great run in multifamily, going from zero units to over $250 million in assets. That's over 2,000 apartment deals that we've been able to purchase through our framework, Buy Right, Manage Right, and Finance Right.
Now, Jake and I, we created the Jake and Gino community back in 2015. We launched our first book, Build Our Profits. And since then, our students have closed over 60,000 units. That's over $4 billion in assets they've been able to close over the last 6 years.
And that's why this community has been so successful. We call it results-based education, and we pour back into the community everything that we've learned on our journey from zero to 2,000 units and all our systems and scale that we use on our very own property management and investing companies.
Jake, I love that. It's not just education, it's implementation. So what I want you to do, click on that link down below, apply to work with our team, see how we can help you on your journey in multifamily.
Chris, I'm a little excited to hear it because as people are sitting there, they're like, it's too good to be true. And why have I not heard of this? Why are they keeping this from me? And I have my own theories about it because they want your money. They want you to be enslaved. If you have autonomy, you don't need them. But Chris Nagel has autonomy. He can make his own decisions. He has his own quote unquote private bank. And I think once you're opted out of the system and you have your own system, I think the rules are different. I think you start writing your own rules.
You do write your own rules, 1,000%. And that's exactly what I'm going to tell you, how I started writing my own rules, just following these simple philosophies of becoming your own bank and mimicking what banks do every day, that we can just take back control and just do the same thing.
Shoot, let me hear it.
Oh, okay. Sorry. So let me give you an example here real quick. You want to buy a car. Let's use a G-Wagon. Since we were talking about G-Wagons, nobody can explain why they never buy any other vehicle when they own a G-Wagon. But those that own a G-Wagon know that, like, it's the greatest vehicle ever, even though it's just a big chunk of steel that's terrible on gas. So here's the thing. You know, I've owned a few of them now, but let's say the last one, it was about $129,000. I don't buy brand new vehicles. So it was $129,000. Now, a lot of people would be like, that's a lot of money to pay for a vehicle. Some of you on here are like, ah, that's cheap. But $129,000 gets you about a $2,400 a month payment if you finance through a bank. So you want to know how I buy it? So in my policies, so this is the bad part, I need to have $129,000 saved in my banking system, my policies. And I have a series of about 10 policies just myself. So I got $129,000 here. I find this vehicle. First thing I did is I had the place that had it, which was a dealer. I had them go through and figure out what the best financing would be for a five-year loan. They came back to me and they said, okay, we found a place. It was, I think back then it was like 3.9% interest and over 5 years, and it was Ally Bank. I'm like, great. Can you send me the amortization schedule? Sure, here it is. Then we're getting ready to buy the vehicle. He's like, you want me to send you the credit forms? I said, no, I'm just going to pay cash. He said, oh, okay. He didn't even ask. So I then took a loan from my policy, which takes 36 hours to get my money. I can get it overnight, but I got to pay for a wire, and I was being cheap. So I got the $129,000 and I wrote the check, or I actually wired the money to this dealer, right? Now they've got $129,000. They shipped the vehicle to me. Most people, that's where they stop. That's where they stop. Those of you that stop when you do it that way, whether it's from a bank or from your policies, you've lost the game, because now $129,000 stopped working for you. And that's a lot. If I ran you a compound interest calculator, even at 3.9% or 3.8% over 20 years, it's a significant amount of money. So when you pay cash for something like this G-Wagon, that money can't work for you anymore. But because I changed where that $129,000 went first, it went into the policy, and then I took a loan from the insurance company, that money did not stop working for me. But we got to add one more step. Remember I mentioned that Ally Bank would finance a car about $2,400 a month over 5 years. So what I did is I just said, okay, I borrowed money from my bank, so I'm not going to steal from my bank. I'm going to literally pay my bank exactly what the cheapest bank out there would have gotten, $2,400 at 3.8 or 3.9%. So I set up a bill pay for $2,400 and change. Every single month, a bill pay comes out of my main bank account, my checking account, which I don't keep much money in banks, and it goes over to my policy. So think about it this way, folks. I just draw a circle. I had $129,000 in my policy on the left side of the circle. I moved it over to the right side to this vehicle, which most people think is a terrible investment when you buy a vehicle. Doesn't matter if my car is only worth $80,000 today to me, but most people are like, that sucks. Then I take $2,400 a month and I send it around the bottom part of the circle, and it lands back in my private banking system, because why would I give it to somebody else's bank when I have a banking system? Every $2,400 I put back into my policy is available the next day when my check clears. You cannot ever buy a vehicle and use somebody else's bank, make your $2,400 monthly payment on the car, and then call the bank and say, hey guys, hey, yeah, you know that payment I just sent you, you got that, right? Oh, thank God. I need you to send me that back. I need to use it tomorrow. The bank would laugh at you, right? But you see, when you own the bank, the $2,400 I just put in there as my payment on my truck, that money's available. But it also, that money's not just available. It also reduced the $129,000 loan that the insurance company gave me, meaning that the 5% on that $129,000 is now not 5% APR. It's less because the balance is lower and the amount they're charging makes the APR less. And every time I pay a payment, every month, that money goes back into my policy. So what happens? Well, after 5 years, $129,000 has made its way back into my policy, but I've also got some extra money left over. Because remember, I was reducing the loan balance, so my APR is less. So even though the loan balance or the loan amount was only 3.8 and the insurance company charges me 5. So pay attention, folks. Insurance company charges me 5 and I'm only paying myself back at 3.8. People think I'm losing money. I might have in the first couple of years, but when that balance got down, my APR is lower than 3.8 and then it's lower and lower. So all the spread on the back end of that loan is mine to keep. So I didn't just make money on $129,000 that stayed in my policy earning interest. I also made a spread on the loan because the insurance company charged me less on the loan than I paid myself back. But now, like the Porsche I just mentioned. Now let's repeat that same thing with a Porsche. I just bought a Porsche. Interest rates are not 3.8 anymore. The same thing I did with the Porsche. I said, what's the loan interest rate? 8.3% on a used car. So I said, all right, if they're going to charge me 8.3, I'm going to pay myself back 8.3, $1,478 a month. But now do the math. If the insurance company charged me 5 and I'm repaying 8.3, what's the spread? Pretty darn good, right?
Yeah.
Plus I get this all the money back for the Porsche. So I'm driving a car that I got all the money back. Plus I made a spread twice. Like, you want to talk about how you never ever make less money in the future? You control the banking system in your life. You take back control of the banking system in your life. Don't give money to other banks. Start your banking system and have all the money land there. So we just talked about cars. The same thing with credit cards. Pay your credit cards down one at a time. Take the payment you were given Visa, put it back into your bank every month. Okay. The money doesn't change. It's the same as what you were giving away. You're just now paying yourself back. You're building wealth through your own debts and expenses. Today, I'm huge about lending, and I created an entire lending platform. It's just a community of lenders and borrowers, private lenders and borrowers, and it's called Private Money Club. And I did this because I started accumulating lots of money. There's only so many cars you can buy, and once you pay off all your debt, you're like, all right, what am I going to do with all this cash in my banking system? And banks don't survive if they don't lend money. So I started lending money on real estate deals. Now, I've done 274 flips to date. Hated every single one of them. I've owned almost 100 rentals, which I've sold most of them off because the market was just too good not to sell. And I lend that money now to real estate investors. So just take the same thing with the car. Somebody needs 200 grand. I take a loan from my policy. I give them 200 grand in first lien position with a personal guarantee. They make a monthly payment. Okay. So let's call it $2,400. That's 12%. I take the $2,400. I put it back in the policy every month. And then eventually they sell the deal. I get the 200 grand back. I rinse and repeat the process over and over and over again. Like the cycle just continues. So you talked about the difference between rich and wealthy. Wealthy figured out how not to give their money back.
And there's a couple of things that I want to reiterate about what Chris is talking about. When you have premiums on a whole life policy, the premiums are consistent. They won't go up. So if you lock in a premium, let's say $10,000 a year, it's going to say $10,000 a year. Because I opened my first policy back in 2001. It was $5,000 a year back in 2001. I'll never forget it. I'm still paying the $5,000. It's returning me 12 to 15 grand. I forgot what the last one was, like 13 grand. This last payment, like Chris said, you put a dollar in. As time goes on, you get more than a dollar. And this is the other one. This is the other caveat for real estate investors. When you pass away, you may not be liquid. You may need some capital to pay some death benefits, some death taxes. The death benefit is there to allow you to do that. So not only do you have living benefits, you have death benefits as well. I'm not trying to sell or promote whole life. I'm just trying to make people understand that this tool has multiple uses. If you have an estate plan, and I know 70% of the people in this country do not have an estate plan, but truthfully, 100% of us do, because if you don't have one, the state has one for you. And so make sure, make sure you have one, and then start with the estate plan, start with the will, start with your trusts, power of attorney, healthcare proxy. I'm on here to tell you, you need to protect yourself. And that whole life is a major component of planning. And once again, it's a life benefit, and it's also a death benefit. Chris, before we sign off, a couple more questions, real quick. books. Where can people get more knowledge? Where can they learn more about the strategy? And give me one book you've read in the last few months that you really enjoyed.
Oh, gosh. All right. Well, to get more knowledge about what we were just talking about, there's plenty of books. But the main book you should read is called Becoming Your Own Banker by the late R. Nelson Nash. He pioneered infinite banking. It's called Becoming Your Own Banker. When you're done with that, I've written several books. You can get all my books at chrisnoggle.com. It's called Mapping Out the Millionaire Mystery. It's Advanced Strategies of IBC. And then there's plenty of other books like Pirates of Manhattan that are really interesting.
Yeah.
A book that I've read and I'm reading again that I'm just infatuated with is Shoe Dog about Phil Knight and Nike. I don't even like Nike. I don't wear Nikes. Like, I don't like the company, but his story is so amazing because it's a story of an entrepreneur going through the ups and downs and the ups and downs. And that's what I love, is that journey. So that's my favorite book I'm reading right now. And David and Goliath was another really good one.
Awesome. Where can they get your information? One more time, give me the website.
Yep. ChrisNoggle.com, or you can go to my YouTube channel at The Chris Noggle. So all my channels are at The Chris Noggle.
This has been a real fun podcast for me, because I'm going to say it. If a snowboarder who started a clothing line called Fat can understand money, then the pizza guy has got hope. The drug rep has got hope. And you listening have hope, because it's not that complicated. You just have to change your paradigm. You have to change the way you look at things. And once you understand that wealthy people do certain things a certain way, it's more of the mindset than anything else. Once you understand that, success leaves clues. Go out there and see what people are doing to create this wealth, to create success. Start following them and start following what their strategies and what their techniques are. And you incorporate real estate, you incorporate the infinite banking, you put those two together, it is like gasoline. Mr. Noggle, great podcast. I loved it today. Thanks for being on, brother.
Had a lot of fun. It was an honor and a privilege.